audience participation?
That would be fun. I would be participating.
Exactly.
We are going to open the Joint Committee on Student Success February 23rd, 2018. We have a nice little agenda here, getting some information from people that the committee continues to ask for. And continue to let us know information that you would like to gather, as well as give us information again on as we start setting up for going around the state, places you think would be of good interest to us to look at, because we're looking for that. We did send out a general request to all members of the House and Senate, asking them by next Tuesday to get in information that they might have about places in their districts or places around the state that they've heard of that they think would be good for us to look at. Because it is our intention to get as much information from all corners of the state during the next 8 months or 9 months before we come in next session. So, again, thank you. Go, Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair Roblin. I just had a question about that. Do you have a list now or a proposed list or something of where you're thinking or where the two of you are thinking?
So we met this morning to start that conversation amongst ourselves. We're meeting again on Monday to continue that conversation. But we would like you to have other issues and anything you feel is important. We gathered information from, at the time, well, Colt Gill, our Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, had gone on a tour to look at issues around the state. And we asked him for his input. We've asked people like the Chalkboard Project. We've asked groups and any of the other people, COSA, any of them, OEA. If there are places that they think would be helpful for us, we would love to entertain any of those conversations and why. We want, because there have been a lot of conversation here about the kinds of things we need to look at, we want to have as many opportunities as we can. We are also early childhood education, so those are important to us. So if you know of places and you can let us know, we're kind of tentatively getting a few places early. Our goal is to, as soon as we get out of here, to start actually in March with some meetings and then do as much as we can while school's in session, because we would like to talk to kids and see the schools in operation. We will probably do a couple things in the summer, probably July. August is a time when most things aren't going on and we wouldn't see much. So then come back late September, early September is difficult for schools. They're doing a lot of work. And then if we have time in October, November, depending on what works out and where we're at. So, and we will take some of those trips when they go a ways away to do a couple of them, spend a couple of days and hit two sites so that we can get more input from places around Oregon. Any other questions or thoughts about that? Yes.
Really quick, Mr.
And we're meeting with Representative Smith on Monday night.
Wonderful. So, Mr. Co-Chair, really quickly, I want you to know how much I appreciate your leadership. With that said, Capital Construction is meeting right now as well.
That's right.
And so I'll be over in the Capital Construction for the next hour, and then if we're still remaining, I'll try to make it right back.
Yeah. We do appreciate you being in Capital Construction. And anything you can spend in my district would be helpful.
No. That's what we can do.
We do appreciate Capital Construction. Thank you. And thanks for coming to let everybody know.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just had a speaking engagement with the League of Women Voters a few minutes ago, and they expressed a couple of things that they wanted the committee to think about. And that would be, when we take the show on the road and make our various stops, will we carve out any time for anyone who wants to talk confidentially and not before the larger group? And there was also a request for us to perhaps make some time for individual business people that may need a little time with us while we're in their area.
So thank you very much for that question. We are planning when we go to each of the locations we're going to carve out time in particular for school people, superintendents from the area, whatever, because when we have the evening meeting, we really like input from parents and community members and so on. We will also be asking in each of those places for businesses that have interacted with the school in different ways so that we can make site visits to some of those, other conversations about those same kinds of things. So our goal is to do a lot of stuff when we get there and not just the other. So confidential in the sense that we'll have a smaller meeting with other groups of people. All of this is open meeting stuff, so we don't really have confidential that way, but smaller groups with a focus so that they don't take up all the time in the meetings when we're trying to get a hold of parents. Yes.
Okay. I hope that makes sense to everybody.
That's kind of where we're at right now with what we're looking at. So if you have suggestions of those kinds, please let us know. Anybody that's out there that understands we're doing this, know that you can write to the committee. It becomes part of the permanent record. So we'll make sure that as time goes on, everybody knows how to get a hold of Lisa and here at the Capitol, so we can have that kind of stuff. And it is on the agenda that you would have. And if you look online, you can see the joint committee and who to contact there, too. So if you have any of that information that you think would be helpful for us to know or places you think would be important to see, let us know, because we want to make sure as we go through this that the solutions we come out with are Oregon solutions from Oregon people talking to a group of legislators that represent pretty much all of Oregon. So thank you for that. So with that, and I know our agenda is tight always, we're going to start with an informational meeting on graduation requirements, instructional time, Colt Gill and Emily Mazzaro. We'll open that.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Roblin and Smith Warner, members of the committee. We are happy to be here today to share a little bit of information on graduation requirements in Oregon and instructional hours. I will particularly be gliding right through a few of these slides rather quickly, but we wanted you to have the information. And so if you have further questions about the information's graduation requirements seem like a simple subject, but there's a lot of detail there. So if you have questions at some time, feel free to reach out to me and we will get answers for you on those. So I'm here today, again, Colt Gill, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction at ODE, and we have Emily Nazaroff, our Acting Government and Legal Affairs Manager. And so we'll share this information with you. We're gonna start with the graduation requirements and say that the State Board of Education went under a pretty extensive review of graduation requirements just over 10 years ago. They actually started in September of 2005, and they worked through May of the next year, 2006. They published op-ed pieces in newspapers across the state. They put out an online survey. They accepted written comments and public comments. They got a lot of community feedback in the development of what is our current graduation requirements. They ended up hearing from at least 150 stakeholders who were invited personally to provide input and held a retreat. They had over 300 presentations with focus groups and targeted interviews throughout this timeline. And they had over 5,000 surveys returned on the development of the graduation requirements. So it's pretty extensive. And in January 2007 is when the State Board voted to adopt what was then our new Oregon diploma, our high school graduation requirements. And we still sometimes refer to it as new, even though it's 10 years old now. In Oregon, we have a 24 credit requirement standard for a diploma. There were a number of diploma task forces that were put together during the time that this was developed. So they had an implementation advisory task force, an essential skills task force, standards and assessment, credit for proficiency, cost and capacity, and special education. At the end of all that, this is what was developed. So we have a regular diploma, a modified diploma, and an extended diploma. These were phased in over between 2008 and 2014. Each eighth grade class was given the requirements that they would need to meet in order to earn their diploma once they left high school. So that way, there was no surprises for students who were actually in high school. Each one of these rolled in as students became eighth graders. Our diploma does also require certain things outside the credit requirements. We have personalized learning expectations where students beginning in seventh grade create an education plan and profile. There's career-related learning experiences, and there's credit for proficiency options for our students. Since Oregon implemented its education plan and profile and the personalized learning requirements, many other states added these to their diplomas. So you can find samples of these now in Wisconsin, Indiana, Colorado, New Jersey, Vermont, and Tennessee. There is a research study that was done by Education Northwest, however, that does show that not all of our districts fully implement these graduation requirements, and that further support needs to be provided in order to bring all districts up to this level of use of our diploma. In 2009, the State Board of Education adopted our modified diploma requirements. This is a little bit different. So students earning a modified diploma are now eligible for federal financial aid, though they won't have met the same requirements for entrance into some four-year universities. They may also continue in their school district to try to receive a regular diploma. So they can earn this after 4 years and then continue on and try to earn the regular diploma. There are a lot of decision points for students that are going down a modified diploma path. The initial decision needs to be made no later than sixth grade and no later than 2 years prior to the anticipated graduation date. But the decision can be revised every year or even more often if there's a documented history of the student has changed in some way, so that there's a reason for that change. Students who take a modified diploma route also earn 24 credits. And if you go back to that chart, those are a little bit different, but there's still 24 of them. They still have to demonstrate proficiency with the essential skills, which I'll talk about a little bit more here in a minute, and the personalized learning requirements. If students are currently engaged in the use of any illegal drugs or alcohol, they are not eligible for a modified diploma. So unless they can show some significant learning and instructional barriers are due to the use of the illegal drugs. This information, I'm going to let you review this on your own. This is just more detail about the modified diploma on these next two slides. I'm going to move on. I want to get us into the essential skills section so you can understand where Oregon's at with that. I'll stop here, though, for the extended diploma. So the extended diploma is awarded to students who have not been able to meet the full set of standards with any kind of reasonable modifications or accommodations. It requires a parent or the adult student's consent in writing during the year in which the diploma is awarded. And of the 12 credits, no more than 6 may be earned in a self-contained special education classroom. School districts must ensure that the students have on-site access to the appropriate resources in order to achieve an extended diploma at each high school in the district. And I should say, too, that extended diplomas do not count in the on-time graduation rates for Oregon. So just the modified and regular diploma count. So these different decisions that students and families and educators make on diplomas do have some impacts. The regular, modified, and extended diploma are all considered Oregon diplomas. But like I said, the regular and modified are the only ones that count in the district graduation rates. The FAFSA is available for regular and modified diplomas, not the extended diploma. All completers may participate in graduation ceremonies, so students can participate in those ceremonies with all three of these diplomas. And community colleges accept regular, modified, extended, and other certificates that districts may award. Military acceptance does vary by branch and sometimes other assessments. So you may have also heard about our essential skills in Oregon. So when the State Board of Education adopted these new requirements, they didn't want to base them on credits only, so just the number of courses that a student finishes. They also wanted to ensure that students were ready for a college or career. So they worked in a number of these focus groups and different meetings around the state and got this input on these surveys to determine what is it that we want students to be able to do when they graduate from high school in Oregon. What will make them ready for the workplace? What will make them ensure that they can succeed in college? And so they developed 9 essential skills. The first 4 are ones that you would typically see and be pretty traditional, so reading well, writing well, being able to complete mathematics problems in a variety of settings, and listening actively and speaking clearly. The next 5, I think, are maybe more critical, both to success in college and in the workplace. So we have think critically and analytically, use technology, demonstrate civic and community engagement, demonstrate global literacy, and demonstrate personal management and teamwork skills. So these are all the essential skills that are technically requirements for graduation in Oregon. However, at the statewide level, there are assessments provided for 3 of these 9 essential skills. So we assess students on reading, writing, and mathematics. And they do that typically through the summative statewide assessment, Smarter Balanced in Oregon, in 11th grade. They do have other ways to meet that requirement. They can demonstrate proficiency through work samples or through various other assessments that the school district may offer. And there are some modifications. So the students who are identified as special education, so students with disabilities, work samples may be modified, so through their scoring or through the type of work sample problem that is given to a student. That's determined by the IEP team, the individual education plan team at the school that includes a parent and educators. And achievement cut scores for the statewide assessments may also be modified. Students that are not on an IEP or 504 plan, the statewide assessment scores may not be modified. Work samples may be modified as determined by a school team. And then just a little bit of information about Oregon in relation to other states around the country. So every state in our country determines its own graduation requirements. Some states actually leave that up to local districts and they don't have state level requirements. There are 11 other states that require 24 credits as Oregon does. The quality of the credits may not be the same across all these states. So in Oregon, for example, in mathematics, students are required to earn 3 credits, but they all must be courses that are Algebra 1 or higher. Otherwise, they just count as an elective. So they don't count towards the 3 credit requirement in math. But these are the other 11 states that also require 24 credits. Some of those states offer multiple diploma options. So they have a 24 credit diploma, but they also may have a minimal diploma that requires less credits to earn. So they'll typically call other state diploma options an honors diploma or college prep diploma, college and career ready diploma, things like that. There's a few that have a foundation diploma that's typically a lesser number of credits. And then states vary on the number of requirements, on the requirements for any kind of demonstration of proficiency. So there are some states that require exit exams for certain courses. Some that have exit exams that you must meet to graduate, much like our proficiency in essential skills. And then some don't require any of that. I'll pause there for a minute. This is the end of the graduation requirements piece and see if you have any questions before we move on to instructional hours.
Representative Smith-Wilmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Colt, for being here, and Emily. So I have a freshman in high school who has recently learned about the fact that there are only 24 credits required to graduate and is regularly pestering me about, well, why can't, if he gets all 20, if he gets all 24 credits in 3 years, why can't he be done after he's a junior? Can he be?
Yes, Co-Chair Smith Warner. So yes, in some districts you can be done. Sometimes it is difficult to actually earn the 24 credits in that amount of time because they are sequential typically. So the English credits, for example, there are 4 credits required. So typically students would take 1 per year. But they could. They could take summer courses. They can take online courses. And students can finish early. In Oregon, when you relate this to instructional hours, we have districts in our state that offer an 8-period day or an 8-period week. And so those students can easily earn 32 credits in 4 years, and 24 are required for graduation. Also in Oregon, though, school districts can choose to have higher graduation requirements locally than the state offers. So some districts in our state have 26 credits, for example, or they'll require a financial literacy course, and the state does not require that.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Leon.
Thank you for calling me a senator.
That's right. Anytime.
Thank you, Chair. You're setting aspirations for me. So my question is around, we know we have one of the largest GED option programs in the country in Oregon. So how do you categorize our students who are both working on a GED and a high school diploma at the same time? Because it's not one of your options on your list.
Right. So co-chairs Roblin, Smith-Warner, members of the committee, Representative Alonzo Leon. So in the graduation requirements, what we typically track, we do track the number of students that earn GEDs, and we do report those as well. And then we report the number of students who earn a four-year, a diploma within 4 years, and a diploma within 5 years, and then other kinds of completers as well, which includes the GED. So typically when we talk about our graduation rates, though, we use what's called the four-year cohort graduation rate. And that only measures the students who have earned either, in our state, a modified or a regular diploma. And so the GED students are not counted in that number. And that meets the federal requirements for that calculation. So
follow
that we
up?
Follow up, send yes. those into the...
Thank you. My understanding is that we have students who are that actually work on both
yes.
the high school diploma and the GED. So even if they earn a GED and a high school diploma within the 4 years, they're not counted?
No. So co-chairs Roblin, Smith-Warner, representative. So they would count. So any student who does earn the diploma 4 or 5 years, they'll still be in those counts as well.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying.
Other questions?
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Roblin. A question about the modified diploma. You had mentioned that, and I just want to get a clarification, that if a student was involved with or currently using either drugs or alcohol, that they were exempted from being able to participate in the modified program. And is that a one, can you give me a little more information or details on that?
That's a good question.
Sorry. Yes, co-chairs Roblin and Smith-Warner, Representative Meek. So the ruling on that is that if a student is currently engaged in the use of illegal drugs or alcohol, they are not eligible for a modified diploma if significant learning and instructional barriers are due to the use of illegal drugs. So I think the thinking behind that is that that the modified diploma is meant for students who have experienced difficulty in learning in some way. So they may be identified with a disability. They might have a 504 plan for concussion or something like that. But it's not specifically for the use of a student who has begun using illegal drugs and is then experiencing less effort towards their studies.
Okay, but thank you.
But if they recover from that and then come back into school, then they can earn a diploma again.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair.
Yes.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. I need a clarification. Student-teacher conferences, are they in the minimum hours?
Yes. So co-chairs Roblin, Smith-Warner. So we are about to go over the instructional hours, and Emily will explain that. And they have been in the past and she'll let you know that that's going into the future.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, well, let's go on with the hours.
Okay. Co-Chair Smith, Warner, and Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Emily Nazarov, and I'm the Acting Government and Legal Affairs Manager here at ODE. The State Board of Education adopts minimum required hours for instructional time, and what you see on the screen there is the current standard. And this standard was adopted in 2015. And the standard says that districts have to provide a minimum number of instructional hours, and they have to ensure that a certain percentage of students in the district and at each school are scheduled to receive those minimum hours of instructional time. And so there's a different required hours for each grade band. You can see that up on the screen. And then because this was a change of practice, when we adopted the standard in 2015, the State Board provided for a four-year phase-in to give districts time to meet the standard. So in the first year, they had to ensure that 80% of students in the district were scheduled to receive the minimum hours. Then it went to 85%. This year, in 17-18, they have to ensure that 90% of students in the district are scheduled to receive the hours. And then next year is the final year of implementation, and that's where the districts have to show that 92% of students in the district are scheduled to receive the hours, and 80% of students at each school operated by the district are scheduled to receive the hours. So that's the four-year phase-in. The definition of instructional time, when we adopted the revised standard in 2015, we also tightened up and made a really clear definition of instructional time. And the board said, generally, this is what counts as instructional time, and then gave a list of activities that are also considered instructional time. So travel to and from a CTE facility counts as instructional time. Professional development, if the local school board approves, a district can count up to 30 hours of professional development. Parent-teacher conferences, again, if the local school district approves, you can count up to 30 hours of parent-teacher conferences. There's a study hall if the student's attendance is required and instructional assistance is provided. That may be counted as instructional time. And then I think it was 2 years ago, the legislature passed a law that says up to 15 minutes in the morning can be counted if the students are eating breakfast. That can be counted towards instructional time. And then at the lower level, we allow up to 30 hours of recess for half-day kindergarten, and 60 hours of recess for full-day kindergarten and grades 1 through 3 to be counted as instructional time, because what we heard during the feedback from educators was that that recess really is important for kids learning at that age. So that is the current standard, and I can answer any questions about the standard if you'd like.
Okay, 2 questions.
Okay, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple quick questions on the recess. That's only 1st through 3rd you can count it, and you can't count it after that?
Correct.
That's troubling. How about lunchtime? So we've passed the bill about breakfast time. Does lunchtime count?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, no. Lunch does not count towards instructional time.
Okay. And then my last question, the professional development item. So is that, for example, there's a day in October when all the schools in the state seem to be teacher professional development day, which I thought all teachers had to be doing professional development in. But then I was at the gym last year, and all of my teacher friends were at the gym in the middle of the day as well. I really thought it was like an in-school thing. So is that the kind of professional event, like those dedicated days? Is that where you get those the hours towards? And so, I know it's district by district.
It would be up to the local school board to look at what is being offered in that time and say, yes, this is professional development for our teachers. The rule doesn't state specifically that it has to be required attendance, but if someone called the department for technical assistance, we would say the expectation is that it's professional development that is being provided to teachers who are in attendance at the training.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Carl. Yes. Representative.
So just want to clarify 2 things. So I do believe that the addition of breakfast, which was a legislative decision, was tied to the idea that providing breakfast to all students, so that in some school districts, the best way to do that is to allow the students to bring the breakfast to the classroom.
Yes.
Where oftentimes learning activities are happening. Typically, lunch doesn't happen in the classroom, so it's not called out as instructional hours.
Great point.
It happens in the cafeteria. The second piece is related to the professional development. So that statewide in-service day, historically in Oregon, that was a day when teachers were paid to attend professional development activities. It still is in many districts across the state. However, many districts have that as a non-contract day. It's a non-paid day, and teachers make use of it the way that they choose to at this point. Much of that happened after the 2008 recession, as districts were cutting back days. That's one of the first days most districts cut, so that they avoided student contact time. So that's
great. Thank you. That's very helpful.
Yeah. Now we'll go with.
Thank you. If I could ask a question about the instructional hours for kindergarten. I got a bunch of grandkids around that age now. And I saw 450 hours. So help me understand what that means for those kids. So, let me go with half day kindergarten. 450 hours. So 450 hours over what period of time?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Co-Chair Roblin and Representative Wilson, that would be over the course of the year. So typically, correct me if I'm wrong, you would have half-day kindergarten would be from 8 a.m. to noon, shortly before noon.
And mimicking the typical
school
year
calendar.
For that district.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks.
Other questions? Yes. Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. I also had a question about the kindergarten instructional time. My understanding is that some of the offsets for resets and recess and things like that are up to the discretion of the school district. So the school district could decide not to apply those offsets. It was surprising to me when I first learned about the new instructional requirements that we would expect the same number of hours of kindergartners, 5-year-olds versus 13-year-olds, and leave it up to the discretion of the district whether or not that stood. So,
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Roblin, Representative Fahey, yes, it is up to the district to decide if they want to count recess towards their instructional time total or whether they want to provide all of that as classroom time.
May I add to that as well? So Co-Chairs Roblin, Smith-Warner, Representative Fahey. So most of those decisions around how much time is offered at recess are local decisions, as well as whether they count that as instructional time. So some of our schools and school districts around Oregon do have instructional components to recess. They use specific programs to teach self-regulation skills at recess, to encourage activities, specific activities, and teamwork skills at recess. And so those districts do often count this as instructional time because there is a framework for what they're trying to accomplish at recess. There is also, in kindergarten specifically, guided playtime that has some of the same objectives to it. So a lot of times that will be counted as instructional time. But it is up to the districts, and districts also determine how much recess that they also want to provide that they don't count as instructional time, which may extend their day. So some, fourth grade students could have 2 or 3 recesses in one district, and in another district they only have 1 recess.
So we'll go to Representative Stillman.
Thank you, Co-Chair Roblin. I had a question in regards to instructional time, and then I have just a quick follow-up. So this is a yes or no. So on the instructional time, is it based on, is it based per state? Every state has the ability, their state board of education, to set that instructional time?
Chair Roblin, or Co-Chair Roblin, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Solomon, yes, I believe so, that each state is responsible for, you would have different instructional hours requirements state by state.
And follow up. It does surprise me sometimes when we're talking about, we talked about graduation rates and how we have varied different requirements. And then you're also now looking at instructional time, where you could have another graph of very interesting numbers. And so to me, it's puzzling why some of that would not be set when you're looking at Common Core and different things that people are looking at more of a global curriculum. Why are we not considering that so that everyone can be based on the same? Mm-hmm. So I was just curious.
So Co-Chairs Roblin, Smith-Warner, Representative Solomon, I think that It is true that each state does determine. So some determine by instructional hours. I believe some also determine by a number of school days that are required, and that's not something Oregon does for a variety of reasons. And in Oregon, as you are likely aware, we have some school districts that offer school to students 4 days a week and some 5 days a week. There have been reviews of things like the standards, Common Core State Standards, to say here's the amount of time that you would need to have in school to expect the majority of the students to meet those standards. For example, the kindergarten standards at Common Core, they were built for full-day kindergarten. So students who attend half-day kindergarten, it would be very challenging to get through the Common Core State Standards.
So
you're correct.
We're going to use this for the last question from our good Senator Taylor, since you're 40 minutes over your 20-minute timeline. And we do have four other questions.
Thank you, Co-Chair Roblin. So how hard, and based on just this presentation, and thank you very much for this, and then the other hearings that we've had so far, there seems to be this trend developing of things that are decisions made by the state, decisions that can be made at the district level, and decisions that are made in the CBA negotiations. And I'm wondering how hard it would be, or if we want to make an effort to, it may be, I don't know that the department, from the information that I am aware of that the Department of Education collects, I don't know that you already have that, and I don't want to ask you to go and do more work. But we already are, how hard would it be to, as we're developing, going through these hearings, there are these different decisions that are in the control of different bodies, and I just think it'd be important to make certain that we know that.
And a good question, a good follow-up on that. Anybody that has other questions, if you get them to Lisa, we will have give the department time to find out if they can find that answer for us.
I mean, I don't want to go and create a bunch of it, but whether or not it's valuable for us as a committee to understand where this authority lies for these different subject matters, I can't help but think that we will want to know that information
at
some point.
And the truth is, Lisa could probably do that and figure those things out.
A lot of faith in Lisa.
I do. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll move on and let everybody know that much of the time is taken away. But as quickly as we can, we're going to close that informational hearing. We're going to start an informational hearing on expanding learning time. We have with us Jennifer Davis, National Center for Time and Learning, Harvard University Graduate School of Education, on the phone. So you're on. So thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for inviting me to speak with you today. My name is Jennifer Davis, and I'm the co-founder of the National Center on Time and Learning, which is now embedded within the Education Redesign Lab at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Since 2004, my organization has been working with states, districts, and schools to maximize and expand learning time. Our work began in Massachusetts with a policy initiative that enabled schools and districts serving high-poverty students from across the state to apply for expanded learning time grants of $1,300 per child to implement 300 additional hours to the school day and/or year. In 2007, we began to work nationally and have supported districts in Oklahoma, Colorado, Tennessee, Connecticut, New York, and Hawaii. And a few of the large urban districts we've supported include Chicago, Newark, Boston, D.C., and New York City. State and federal resources, including the School Improvement Grants and the 21st Century Community Learning Center grants, have helped to fund the expansion of school time in those states and districts. We have a policy report on our website called Learning Time in America that provides an overview of the policy trends in learning time in this country. Through our research and experience supporting schools, we have learned a great deal. For example, it's critical to keep in mind that time is a resource, just as money is a resource, and how it is spent matters a great deal. Expanding time across the board in a state or a district will not typically result in higher achievement for students. But if schools and districts are supported through a process to expand time strategically, with a focus on how teaching and learning will change and improve, you can see significant gains. Two of our reports, Time Well Spent and Time for Teachers, summarize how schools have used expanded time to close achievement gaps, empower teachers, and expand enrichment opportunities for students. One important example of our work is the turnaround of Lawrence Public Schools in Massachusetts. Due to decades of low performance, the state of Massachusetts took over the district. My organization helped the new receiver, Superintendent Jeff Riley, to expand learning time by 200 to 300 additional hours in all of his K-8 schools. The time was added in three areas: more time for individualized instruction in small groups for students, more time for collaborative planning for teachers embedded within the school day, and more time for fun enrichment opportunities for students in the arts, music, robotics, and other areas taught by specialists or community partners like the YMCA and the Boys and Girls Club. The expanded enrichment programming enabled teachers to collaborate and to develop new strategies to support students who were struggling. Lawrence has made tremendous gains over the last 5 years, and Jeff Riley was just named the new State Commissioner of Education for Massachusetts. Before I close, I want to just talk briefly about my current work at the Education Redesign Lab, which is focused on increasing social mobility through education. Expanded time, of course, is a key to that work, but implementing community school models are also critical. We believe at this point in the history of education reform, we need to focus on the whole child and what they need to succeed in school and in life. Our work is bridging systems of support for students so that children have access to the supports they need from early childhood through to higher education and or career training. This entails linking systems together from early childhood, health and mental health services, summer programming, and summer jobs for older children. Families with resources are spending more than ever in history on educational opportunities outside of school. So we're focused on students who don't have those opportunities. Thank you for asking me to speak with you today, and I look forward to your questions.
So any questions for our people? Yes, Senator Smith Warner.
Thank you, Representative Robles.
Yeah, thank you. Perfect. I have a hard time saying that.
So I just want to say thank you, Jennifer, and I would just strongly encourage folks on the, I know it's a little different with just a brief presentation on the phone, but please do go to their website and access their materials, because there's a lot of really good information, and this reinforces other things I think that we've all heard, that, you know, just more time isn't, it's that idea of time as a resource, just like as valuable, if not more valuable, than money, that really we can't just throw it at it. The same way we often say we can't just throw more money at problems, we have to figure out how to best use it. The analogy to time is very apt, and there's a lot of good information, I think, on their website that's going to help us.
And the two reports that she mentioned are on OLIS. So yes, we've brought those forward. They do have a lot of other information, though, on their website, and I would encourage people to look at that and to start formulating in your own mind questions that you may have about things, because at the end of the day, when we all come back together to try to figure out what the policies are, we need to really look at these kinds of issues with respect to making differences in different populations of kids and others. And so one size fits all is not always the thing that works. Equity is not being treated the same everywhere. Equity is about making sure you have obligations. So her comments about a lot of our students have these enrichment activities outside at home is really an equity issue, because these other kids don't have that opportunity. And how, if we as a school state are going to provide that, how are we going to do that? So I really do appreciate the work you've been doing, and thank you for your time with us today. So thank you.
Absolutely. And if you have any follow-up questions, Lisa knows how to reach me.
Yep. That would be great. So with that, we'll close that informational hearing, and we're going to open an informational on college readiness. And we'll have Kathleen Brown and Greg Hammon. I always say that wrong. Sorry about that. Whenever I look at it, it's a problem.
Heyman.
I shouldn't look at it, because then I get it right. So.
For the record, my name is Greg Heyman, and I am the president of Lynn Benton Community College. Because of the topic, I also want to let you know I'm also on the board for the National Board for the American Association of Community Colleges, where we've worked and developed National Standards and Strategies for Student Success. I'm also the board chair for an organization called NC3, which is a national organization that establishes industry-based certifications in the career technical field. And I'm also a commissioner on the Quality Education Commission. So I want to talk a little bit about student success. The goal that we have can be stated in a number of ways, and certainly we use the phrase student success, but it's also about community success. And there was a time back where we talked about that in terms of things like 40-40-20, and I just want to remind it, because I do this at my institution, remind you that what we're really trying to do is use education as a resource in order to create a stronger community and a stronger future for our state. And so I want to keep us focused on that bigger work. The things that we're doing at Lynn Benton specifically, focusing on something called Guided Pathways. We're one of 30 colleges nationally that have been working in this area. I want to talk about why this matters. The work is focused on two specific things. One is to establish program pathways for students so that they don't just get in the door, but they actually have a path to a successful educational experience with us. And then we also do something what a variety of people call it differently, but we call it unavoidable guidance. It means that you have a navigator that comes alongside you and partners with you in your educational success. And that's been a critical component of the way in which we work with students. We also have initiated a project called Pipeline, which reaches down into eighth grade and creates information and hands-on experiences, which help students in middle school to begin to think about the pathway that can lead them to jobs, middle skills jobs that exist right in our region, and also understand the educational pathway to get there. We also have a strong equity focus. We do a variety of things in that area, but we recognize both at our institution, statewide and nationally, that not all students achieve at the same level, and that we know that we need to make adjustments in the ways in which we approach students who come to us with different backgrounds in order to make not just access equitable, but to make the outcome equitable as well. So I want to talk a little about the challenges we face and some of the ways in which I hope you as policymakers can help us. First, I want to encourage you to think about this issue systemically and not on the basis of educational sectors. That's a challenge for us. But I want to remind us that high school graduation or completion of a degree or a certificate is not the goal. It's a milepost to that goal that I mentioned earlier. We want to help people grow up and be productive in their life and productive in our communities, and we use educational pathways as a means to get there. And so I just want to keep mindful of that issue. We think in terms of cradle to career, and that we should be working to build a student success strategy that recognizes that much more systemic and integrated strategy. But I would encourage you, because I think the individual sectors are in many ways doing good work, but we lose students at the transition points. And that's really what I want to talk about. If we maybe don't talk this way, but if you think about it, the highest dropout rate is between 12th and 13th grade. What do we want to do about that? So I want to show you a graphic here. This is for my specific institution, but it is 5 years of information, which indicates the percentage of our incoming freshmen who are based on assessment required to do remediation. And you can see there's a combination there. It's hard to read at the bottom, but the 74% category, the highest one, means that 74% of our incoming freshmen coming from high schools are required to take some form of remediation. Okay, 68% of that, in other words, 68%, it's in math, okay? 47%, and it's varied from year to year, but you can see it's pretty consistent, so it isn't like there's an outlier. 47% have required reading, And then Green has just indicated that they would have had to take both. So we have about 40% of our students who require remediation in both of those content areas, math and writing composition.
We have a question right now.
Yes.
So how long have you been tracking this?
Decades, for ages?
Okay.
So, I just showed you 5 years, but it's a consistent pattern. I was thinking,
you know, but did you only start tracking it 10 years ago, or have you been tracking it for 30 years? And is it significantly worse now over time? Which is what we would all assume, I think. But
so what I do, and I want to show you this information, but I also want to caution you in how you interpret it, because I think it's way too easy to jump to the conclusion that this simply means they're not prepared. And I think that that's not necessarily what it means. This is where I want to talk about that intersection a little bit and how I think you can help us with that. One, some of our challenges is we're not always adequately aligned in, I'll use the word curriculum, but that can also mean in terms of timing or sequencing the courses. It can mean content, but it also means methodology of teaching. So frequently, you know, what happens is we use a certain strategy for instruction in one sector, and then we assess learning on the assumption of a different strategy, and so we lose something in that process. One of the challenges that the reason that we are now going to what we call multiple measures, so we're not so wholly dependent on a single assessment tool, so that we can help perhaps mitigate some of the impact of that kind of assessment. We also have watched what other states are doing. California has moved to using the high school GPA as an assessment tool. We would like to do that, but we don't collect high school GPAs in our state data set, and maybe you can help me with that. We would like that. I think there's also cultural transitions. The data would indicate that the vast majority of students who come to us don't drop out for academic reasons. They drop out for other cultural, systemic reasons. And so we know that we need to look at those kinds of things as well. Ultimately, our goal is to eliminate the need for assessment and remediation. And I think a systemic approach to student success will help us with that. Second place in which I hope you can help us is to have a systemic approach to funding. I think we've made some stabs at this in the past, but we still tend to think about sector funding, and we don't think about connecting funding to the whole pathway of a student's educational experience. And I would encourage us to think about that. Yes, education needs more funding. So I'll start with that always. But I'll also say how you give it to us, how you provide that resource to us matters too well. We'll do a better job with resources if we can trust that it will be there from year to year to year. Because in the absence of that trust, we can't invest in long-term strategies. So I want you to think about a long-term funding strategy, not a short-term one. I would also encourage you to connect funding to big goals. We have a tendency to connect funding to strategies or initiative or procedures. Thinking about how do we connect resources to what we actually want to see in the world and see in our schools. And again, connect funding to the full pathway, not to individual things. Third thing I think you can help us with is use financial assistance to help us achieve equity, not just in access, but in outcome. And our strongly suggest, make sure that financial assistance is based on need. We have incredible needs in this state, and we have resources that we could be directing to meet those needs, and I would just encourage you to think about that as well. Also, there has to be there. There has to be that continuity. I need to have a student believe that financial assistance will be there for them for the whole pathway of their educational experience. Otherwise, we haven't solved the resource anxiety that they experience from year to year or term to term. We must deal with that. The last one, At the national level, we see a lot of pressure to think about educational almost solely in terms of its sort of workforce utility. And I certainly want to emphasize that education certainly has workforce utility, and it is the fastest growing part of the work that we do at my institution. But I think we can recognize that for our graduates to be fully functioning, contributing members of our communities, we want to address not just competence, but character. And I want to encourage you to think about how we do that when we address institutional policy. We do it in a statement of values for our institution, which we work to embody, but we also believe that they are educational goals for our students. We don't believe that we're serving our mission, and our mission is to enable all of us to participate in, contribute to, and benefit from the cultural richness and economic vitality of our communities. I would also note that my employers want people who are not only competent, but also have the ability and the desire to employ that knowledge and skill, not just for themselves, but for the betterment of their coworkers, their employers, their families, and their communities. That's a mission that I think we can all share. And I think by focusing on the broad strategy of a systemic approach to education, you can help us in ways that we cannot help ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you. Question? First. So, yes.
Thank
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I want to acknowledge Lynn Benton Community College. So I used to be the GED administrator in my prior life. And I want to acknowledge Lynn Benton Community College because they are very innovative. Many of you guys don't know, but we have one of the highest graduation rates among our GED students, or among our GED populations. And the American Council on Education evaluated the test and came up with 3 recommendations. Among so the first level is that they're equivalent to high school. Second level, that they can bypass the placement test at a community college or university. And the third, they come in with college credit. Mm-hmm. Now, some of it might be policy that we adopt later on, but Lynn Benton Community College was one of the first community colleges that adopted the notion of bypassing the placement test for GED graduates. And they've been doing this for several years now, which in the long run is telling us, one, that our GED graduates are going to college, and two, that they're actually saving money by going through community colleges like Lynn Benton. So I just wanted to acknowledge that I think it's a really big deal, because we have 17 community colleges, not all of them have adopted this policy, but they went ahead without legislative direction, that they were one of the first community colleges that have done that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Senator Roblin and Representative Smith-Warner and members of the committee, on behalf of the Council of Presidents, my name is Kathleen Brown. I am the Student Success Coordinator at Eastern University. I'm also the mother of 2 Oregon Public School graduates and soon to be a graduate from the Oregon University system. Thank you for this opportunity to speak before you today and provide information about our work to support successful transitions for high school students to college. My experience for the past 15 years in teaching and supporting at-risk students at the high school level, higher ed level, has allowed me to observe what the students need to do and be successful at our higher ed institutions. Today I'll be covering issues students are facing and what is currently going on at EOU and ideas to help. In issues, one of the things that I have found in how advising and counseling in the high schools isn't always focused on college-going culture, so students do not take the type of college prep courses that would position them well for success. An example of that, I am a former Aspire mentor at LeGrand High School, and one of my students, when I received her in her senior year, she had decided at the end of her junior year not to take a math class in her senior year because she was done done with the recommendations of what she needed to graduate with, and what that allowed her to do was have an enjoyable senior year. And I told her that was not a good idea. But so when she came to EOU, because I encouraged her to do that and joined our school, she then was placed into Math 40, which is fourth grade math. Because she tested into fourth grade math on the AccuPlacer that has been utilized by many of the institutions in our state. What we tried to explain to them, and I tried to explain to any Aspire student or anybody that's thinking about not taking their math, is that math disappears very quickly. And if you do not continue to do it, it's the one thing that doesn't seem to ever stay. I informed them that I would probably be in Math 40 now, too, if I had not taken it at the right time. So she took Math 40 in her first term. She took Math 70 and was successful in her second, and 95 in her third. The problem was she was going into biology-heavy degrees, so she is now going to be with us for 5 years instead of 4 years, which is $20,000 more than she would have intended to do. So when they make those decisions in their senior, junior and senior year, and we try to get to them before they are seniors, those are decisions that can harm them later on. One of the things that I tell all students to do is you never stop math until you're actually done with the degree that you determined what you're going to have in there. Now, that might not be as much for some, but it is a lot for others. So not just that suggestion to high schools would be massively beneficial for, I assume, community colleges as well as the universities in our system, and is free. Just saying. The other would be particular and reoccurring issues around math and writing. You were sent data on our students at the university level that are in remedial math. You actually can see a decrease in the amount of students that are actually in those remedial classes. I will tell you from my group that I actually track through my student success coordination and through first year experience, a lot of my students are taking it their second year. They didn't even touch math until their second year, which means they will be in a lower math, or that the AccuPlacer allowed them to go into what would be considered Math 95 or 111, which will allow them to take their bio and chem and other classes like that because they are at a high enough level math that they have tested into. But the likelihood of them struggling in those math classes or in stats classes will be probably pretty obvious to them when they start those classes. We do have supports, obviously, in that area with tutoring and other things like that. Currently at EOU, we have one of the things that we have noticed is the study skills that they were supposed to learn, they didn't. Including my own children. Time management, I barely know how to time manage, so they don't either. And also critical thinking skills that we noticed they don't have at all, because oftentimes they had so many highly supportive high school people in their lives that were wonderful people that did not allow them to be adults at any level, including myself with my son. They also have no idea of information literacy when it comes to their library skills. And so in our university studies courses, half of our first year experience courses, which is for our students that are in college level writing and math, we teach them study skills, time management, and critical thinking skills, and information literacy as a partnership with our librarians. So we actually tag team with them, and then also allow our faculty to come into our classes so our students can explore with our faculty, which is considered one of the big six concepts of success in college. In our core 101 and 102, 101 is considered a reading remediation type course, and they will learn how to read and write at the level, and they will be cohorted with a writing 115 course so that they can be prepared by the time they hit writing core 102, that they are ready at basically the same level as Uni 101 students, so that all of our students, when they are out of our first year experiences, the goal is that they are at the exact same spot. The reality is that is not always the case, but we try the best that we can. The other things that we do is with student success is we actually have provisional admit tracking. I'm actually on that committee and the one that actually tracks them. And those are students that have not reached our GPA or other standards or are deficient on their math or English or anything like that. And we actually track them for a year. We track them on every single thing. We track on how they pick their classes, how they did in those classes, what they are in, what their finances are doing, if they're struggling, if they're on early alert, anything like that, I track that. I'm also in charge of the alert program. So basically, I'm said to be the bulldog that goes and finds any kid that I need to find if there's an issue. And if I need to go to your coach, I will go to your coach. And if I need to go and find you at the grocery store, I'm going to find you so that we can make sure that you're successful. The other thing we also do is intrusive advising and student affairs support for all. So if I need to go to housing and I can't find a student, I will find that student through housing. So instead of me doing all of the work, we make sure that my office is basically the hub that then does the spokes out to wherever we need success, so then that the faculty are at the outside of that. I'm also the director of the Summer Institute, which is for our high school students to come up as a bridge program. And basically we will have 50 students come this summer to two different institutes, and we will help them with scholarship development so that they will not have as many issues with finances. We will also give them opportunities during that institute that will actually be viable things for a scholarship instead of them just hoping we can figure out how to write down stuff they've never actually done. So we're trying to recognize that sometimes you haven't done anything yet, so we're going to help you out with that. We're also going to teach them how to actually write at the college level, because many of our students do not have any clue how to write at the college level. And finally, as ideas to help, encourage those students that are juniors and seniors to take their math classes and writing classes. It's great that they want to be in AP history, and it's great that they want to be in AP bio, and those are amazing, but the math and the writing is going to hold you back, not your AP bio and AP history. So please encourage that. That is a free encouragement that would not cost a dime. The other thing that I highly recommend is a bridge program of some sort that helps students successfully over the summer for about a month to get their information for their math, so that when they do test, they're at a higher level when they test, so that they can skip math 40 and math 70 and save thousands of dollars. And closing, I have a story of my specific student worker who's will graduate this spring. He started in CORE. Only 4 years ago, he was a great kid that struggled with the realities of college. He struggled through his first term of Math 70 unsuccessfully and didn't even try again until spring of the same year, where he received a B in the college level math course. He is currently taking his third attempt of stats, and he is finally getting it and loving the subject. He is taking 20 credits, recovering from his second knee injury with A's and B's in all his upper level classes. I know that because he knows I'll ask, so he just tells me now. Through hard work and 4 years of summer courses, he will graduate this spring and will go on to be what we dream all of our students will be, a successful member of society that will impact it for the better. That is my goal for all students who have a desire to make higher education their goal. I am here to take out any and all barriers that the goal without lowering standards, so students know they have earned their degree, not simply had it given to them. In closing, as your committee work continues, we would welcome you to EOU campus for the full interim committee hearing, or as individuals to tour, meet with our students, our professors, and other partners in the education community across the region to help advance the mission of ensuring success for every student in Oregon. Thank you.
Any questions? Yes.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
You're doing really well at questions.
Thank you. Thank you both for being here. I wanted to say I love the concept of intrusive advising, because when I think about the supports we need for first generation low income kids with no history of college or higher ed participation, that is exactly how I think of it. So thank you for giving me a name to use on it. And then just a couple of quick things. Why only 50 kids in that bridge? That is out of how many incoming freshmen?
So Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Co-Chair Roblin. it is actually for just high school students. It doesn't have to be, they're not necessarily even coming to EOU. They're from ninth grade to 12th grade. So we're trying to, last year we had 25 that came, most of them from like the Morrow County area. We had 25, I've doubled it into two different institutes for this for this summer. But those are just students that we believe are thinking about going into college, and what that allows us to do is tell them what they really are going to need if they're going to go to college, no matter where they go to college.
Okay, so it's not like I had.
It is not our income.
Like a ninth grade, like a high school warm-up kind of class, but it's not that.
Okay. No, it can be an M.
Great. And then the last two things I just wanted to say, I would be interested to hear going forward more thoughts, your thoughts about remediation, about kind of the models of it, because I've heard some interesting stuff about how instead of just putting kids into a lower level class, putting them in a regular level but giving them 2 to 4 weeks before, giving them extra hours in that. And then I do want, we've gotten a little bit of information from the universities about the remediation numbers, and I'm going to be asking for more, and with more breakouts and more percentages to get a better handle on what those numbers are. So, but thank you both very much.
And we'll do a question over here.
Thank you,
Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am curious, because you have a very strong cultural competency program at EOU. I'm wondering what your demographics are like for your students that you're working with.
Okay. I'm not used to this. Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Roblin, and Senator Frederick. We have a large portion of our students are of Caucasian descent, but we are also pushing to go to a lot of other students. We actually have a large group of Islander students in our area and in our community, and we also have African American and a few Native Americans because of the area in Pendleton, and then also Latino students. And so, but the majority would be Caucasian.
I wasn't worried about the majority. I just wanted to figure out who, what, both the ethnic and the economic demographics, if that's possible.
Economic, you are looking at most of our students are going to need, they are going to actually be able to get significant assistance from the government because of low economics. They are coming, we have a lot of first generation, I do believe we're like 60 to 70% of that could actually be in a TRIO program, so they could be in a, there's a lot of first generation and special coming from special needs backgrounds and different things like that. We have a lot of students who just aren't prepared. We also have a lot of non-trad students. So a lot of times we talk about the high school and their preparation for it, but we also have students that are coming 20 years after they did high school, and they're having the exact same remediation, because if you thought you forgot it in a year, you really forgot it after 20. So we work with, I mean, I know it's gone from me, and maybe you guys are a lot better at this.
We can get more of that detailed information.
Yeah, we can get like detailed information.
We'll get that.
I apologize.
That'd be very interesting. Thank you very much.
Yes.
And our last question for this group.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I just wanted to say I really appreciate this opportunity that we are having these discussions and these reports. And though I have really appreciated everyone that has come today, I just think, Ms. Brown, right? Mm-hmm. You had like mic drop moments. Yes. Like you just like share it and then you could just drop the mic. Because so much of what you talked about as far as credit alignment, you talked about students and their gaps in their education and the remedial issues, just as others have touched on. The service that you provide is really trying to grab those students and bring them in. It reminds me of a similar thing, the methods that Texas turned around and they were looking at doing and working on. But you had mentioned about remedial courses and having how it's extending their time in college. But it also reflects on their scholarships and their grants and their loans as well, because they can't use that money towards those classes, is that correct?
Only Math 40, at least at our institution. Math 40 FAFSA cannot be used. So if a student has to take Math 40, the problem is they have to be at 12 credits to actually use their FAFSA, which means that you are putting a person that is already at risk in 15 to 16 credits so that they can have the money to actually afford to actually go there, but then you've actually kind of created an issue. And so then we have to try to support them because we're like, they really have no business being in 15 to 16 credits, but they have to in order to be able to even afford the other classes.
And then follow up to that?
Yes.
I was just kind of curious about when you're looking, you talk about a lot about your tracking, and I'm hopeful that the state longitudinal system is going to be working into that process. But do you find an issue between credit alignment, like courses that students have taken, and going into community college, that they're not receiving that?
From the high school?
From the high school for dual credit, accelerated credit issues?
From a personal children thing that is now there. I find that we focus a lot on our technical students, and they do great, and we're really expanding that as a state. We do amazing things for our college-bound students, but that middle group, we kind of forget to tell them, hey, baby, you need to keep going with your stuff, because my child went in with 32 college credits. So that's not the students we're worried about. We're worried about that middle group, and they're not aligning it. But they often have parents that don't know to align it. So we need to empower the parents and also in the students and also the counselors to say, you have to align this so that they have a better chance.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Quickly.
Oh.
Because we have another group that...
Chair Roman and Representative Solman. One of the things we're hoping to come out of the transfer legislation that you passed in the legislative session is a clear identification of courses that will readily transfer to the college level so that students don't experience the problems of that credit transfer. And so that focus on the transfer legislation will be very helpful, not just to us, but to students, so they make sure that they are taking courses that will apply to the pathway that will lead to the goal that they have to themselves. So.
And so what I would say is the comments and the questions that were just said, I really do appreciate you, and the fact that your president of your university came in to watch all of that, and he should take note that of the nice comments made to you, while he was here. So we'll follow up with him as
okay.
well. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So with that, we'll close that hearing, and we get to start an informational hearing. And I'll just take this is one of those that I get to be kind of proud of, because it's Marshfield High School is on the line from Coos Bay, where I spent 32 years of my life. And we have our superintendent, who was a student when I was there at one time, Brian Trendle, on the line, and along with Michael Lavriere, who is the general manager of Southern Oregon Marine, SOMAR, which is a construction. They make barges and outfit barges in Coos Bay. Soss Brothers is another name for the whole group. But thank you for both being here, and I'll turn it over to you. I guess, Brian, are you going to start, or whoever wants to talk a little bit about...
I suppose I could start. I just want to thank the committee for allowing us to talk a little bit about our program, and I want to start with
we certainly would love you
to come down and spend some time.
And make sure you identify yourself, Brian. Brian, make sure you identify yourself.
It's one thing to just talk about it. It's another to see it in action. And so we really encourage the committee to make the Southern Oregon coast one of their stops along the way.
So who are you?
Brian. We have very strong
they're not hearing us.
CTE programs.
They can't be on mute.
Manufacturing is the one that you all are asking the most about because of our partnership with Soss Brothers and SOMAR. It is a very strong manufacturing program started by Tom Hull probably about 10, 12 years ago. Tom really took our program and got it back to where it was a great partnership with industry. He brought in folks from Soss and from our sheet metal industry to be on his advisory committee. so that he was making sure that he was doing the welding techniques and he was doing the skills that our local industry needed in their folks coming out and trying to go into to their job sites and to work. And so that's been a really good partnership. When Tom retired, we were a little bit nervous, but we were able to hire what we think is a dynamite person in Glenn Crook. He brings a degree in engineering from OSU and also some years as a millwright. So he brings some industry experience. He brings his engineering degree and has really taken that manufacturing program and turned not just to the end product, but to the beginning piece where the kids are learning to design and engineer their products and then go out and build them and be able to have those welding skills. I could talk for a really long time about our manufacturing program and the great things that we have going on, but I think I'd like to defer to our representative from SOMAR and hear a little bit and allow you to hear a little bit, because you're short on time, about that partnership.
Also, Brian, can you hear me?
Yes.
You need to identify yourself and make sure he does, for the record. So who are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Brian Trendle. I'm superintendent of Coos Bay School District. Born and raised in Coos Bay, a product of Coos Bay Schools, and in my 21st year in the district, my second year as superintendent.
Thank you. So now we'll hear from our other guest, Michael. And do identify yourself, Michael. Perfect.
Yes, this is Michael LeRivière. I'm general manager with Southern Oregon Marine, which is the shipyard division of Soss Brothers in Coos Bay. Soss Brothers, of course, we're in our 82nd year as a corporation here in Oregon. We are located in Coos Bay as far as our headquarters, and that's where the Southern Oregon Marine Shipyard is located. We've got approximately 75 employees, and a lot of the projects that we work on that Brian has kind of deferred to for me to talk about are obviously marine-going vessels. We repair, maintain, outfit a fleet of tank barges, deck cargo barges, tugboats, dry docks, and other special projects here in Coos Bay. And we consistently have job openings for the types of positions, obviously, that work on these vessels. Those would be fitter, welders, painters, mechanics, carpenters, electricians, and et cetera. And Senator Roman, as I know, you're the former principal of Marshfield, and so you're well aware of the program, and we're thankful for your support of that program over the years. I've been with Soss Brothers just over 4 years, and I know that relationship has gone on much longer than the 4 years that I've been here. But I know you care about the students in Coos Bay, and you recognize that these students, they have many career paths, and we're thankful for your continued support of those different pathways to career success. We at Soss Brothers, we believe that offering welding or other skilled training programs in the high schools allows the students to graduate and enter the workforce immediately with career-long opportunities. What's often unrecognized or under-recognized, excuse me, is that these jobs are high-paying with benefits and the ability to advance into higher skilled and even higher-paying jobs. We at Soss Brothers, we recognize there's a commitment to the community and with the community, and we offer a good living wage job. Our average wages are ranging anywhere from $16 to $30+ an hour, and the majority of those wages are in the mid-20s, and these are all the same careers that we're talking about, the fitter, welders, the mechanics, the electricians, carpenters, and so on. So they're the careers that Marshfield is training their students for, and they're right here in the local community. But these programs can only work as long as the students can see the pathway to the success and the salaries associated with them. These programs work, especially, you know, we realize that college and higher education isn't for every student. For some, it absolutely is. However, students shouldn't feel inadequate or inferior, so simply because they don't go to college. Going into these skilled trades should be championed as well. You know, we hear a lot about college debt, students graduating with a degree but not necessarily able to get a job. And too often we hear that they didn't know a job in the trades was even an option or a possibility. They didn't know the salaries and the benefits associated with those skilled jobs that, you know, we and quite frankly other shipyards offer. This isn't obviously limited to shipyards. The employees can go into countless jobs across the country. And it's just something that we've recognized a long time ago, and we've partnered with some of the local educational institutions. But one of the things that we've noticed is we cannot forget that we've got to be teaching the basics as well. A lot of on-the-job training is done, but we can't do this training if we can't get the students to the job. If they don't understand that the jobs are available, if they're just not aware of these things. Too often, we have employees who just plain don't know how to show up or pass a drug test. I know that's a low bar to set, but it's critical, and we don't want to forget to teach that. But this problem is in no way associated with just the Tuesday operation. As a company, it's an issue we face in California, Washington, and again, Hawaii. But it's also an industry-wide problem. And I hear from other shipyards and companies across the country that they're suffering from the same type of problems we are. I don't have a particular solution, but I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention it today. And we're talking about student success, so we cannot forget that we've got to teach them about the basics.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh, you're welcome.
No, I really appreciate it. I see a lot of nodding heads up here at the dais because we agree. And I think one of the recurring themes as we talk to industry has been show up, no drugs, and be ready to learn stuff. We don't necessarily expect you to know everything you need to know the first day, but we certainly expect you to show up on time. And for a lot of them, comments earlier were on time means before it's time to be there, not the moment before. So I agree with that. And I was going to give Brian a shout out. He can talk about others, because we do have a carpentry program and we do have a radio and television program also at the school. And we're hoping, because one of your graduates contacted me the other day because he got accepted for a pilot program on ABC, which may be called Marshfield, a little fishing community on the coast. So we'll see if that works out. But again, he started in our little television program a long time ago. So other programs that you have, Brian, if you want to just say a moment about the kinds of things.
Absolutely. You alluded to the construction program. We have a strong construction program. The kids actually built the construction building, the new building out back of our high school, and they were involved in the building of the actual shop. And they have opportunities of apprenticeships, college or trade school, and direct to the workforce. Some of our kids get nationally certified in carpentry and are able to go right out into the workforce. Our advanced carpentry class works with Habitat for Humanity and works to build a home each year here in our local area for our low-income folks to be able to realize that home of that goal of home and owning a home. And so our construction program is another one of our strong programs. You alluded to the multimedia program. It is a student-run business. Our students run that radio program. It is an actual live radio program. Our students write and produce many of the ads that go on the radio for a lot of our local businesses. And so they run a pretty strong business. So a lot of our kids in that program maybe not necessarily go into the media profession, although a few of them have. Many of them have that business background, having run that program as its own business, and so they're able to go into a business program and try to expand in that career. We also have a technology program. We have six former graduates, recent graduates that are PC Pro certified. Four of them are at our local community college taking programs that are industry related. One went on to a university to become an IT professional, and the other one is was hired right out into the field by Spectrum, and he got that job because of the certification he was able to earn in our technology program. A newer program that we just added, thanks in part to Measure 98 funding, is our health science career pathway. That one we just got on board this last year, and three students completed that program, and all three are at the college level continuing programs in that field. And so we feel very good about our five strong programs. We we feel like they fit a niche for our kids, and as was said before, not every kid is going to go to college. A lot of these kids are going to go to a trade school, or they're going to go into the industry and be able to be trained there. But we do need to build on those partnerships. I think the point that was made, many of our kids don't really realize the job potential that's out there and the benefits and the wages that are out there, and that's something that we could certainly increase with our students and a program that we would like to look at as far as trying to get those kids connected with those programs. And maybe they are in an internship while they're in high school, and that internship leads into a job when they exit high school. So we're certainly, although proud of our programs, looking to expand on what we're doing down here, and that's a big piece of it.
So Brian and Michael, questions here. So we have a question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just was curious, are these programs that they are seeking out, so with like SOMAR, is that something that the school district went out and got a partnership with, or is the local Chamber of Commerce, like their school to career program, are they involved in helping with this?
So
are they?
Do you remember, I think it was Tom Hall that was our original chieftain, who actually went down to SOMAR and started having that conversation with the Soss Brothers people about making this connection.
But then all the other programs, are they?
All the others, we've actually developed them ourselves. One of the local radio stations gave us a radio station because they didn't think they could use it. And we had a local guy whose family was radio, and he came up and volunteered to put it together. And then we got another radio station from the federal government when they opened up some FM stations, so we have two stations there now. And we have individual people in our community who were from our community who stepped forward to help us with that. And then we got them vocationally certified through the ways you can vocationally certify people. The nursing one, they just started.
All of our programs have advisory committee members that are from the local industry, and so there's a connection there.
Yep.
But I think there's more we could do. I'm sure we can do more. It's just trying to find that, where do we start with the funding, and who is that person that's out there making those connections?
Yeah, but it is, and we have had active groups in our chamber and others to do those kind of things. But I think in each of the cases that you've talked about, those advisory groups are a requirement for certification, and they went out and searched those people to be on their advisory team.
Wow.
So.
Fantastic.
And that can happen in any community. I mean, we're not talking about a big community.
Right.
So that's the thing. I think some people think, oh, you can't do it here because we don't have anything. You've got businesses in every town. So Brian, it looks like that's all the questions. I want to thank you and Michael for being on the phone today. I appreciate Soss Brothers a lot personally, just because they're a company that doesn't have to be in Coos Bay. They've made a choice. It's another family company. They do a lot of stuff with Vigor up here in Portland, and they've made a personal commitment to being in our community. They also made it, the statements about drug-free and other side, they've told us that a lot. So, you know, and they, but they've also provided materials to our shop classes, which are very expensive anyway. It is that relationship with these companies that have given us materials for our kids to use. So.
Yeah, absolutely, and a big thank you to Sauce Brothers, and thank you to the committee for allowing me to brag a little bit about what we got going on down here. But there's more we can do, certainly.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Yes, I'd like to thank the committee as well, but I'd like to extend an offer to come to Coos Bay and come to Southern Oregon Marine and see some of these jobs in action. And a lot of these students that have gone on to take these careers are still with us. We have employees that have been with us for 30-plus years that have grown up in the community and saw the opportunity. And we'd like to share that with all the students and let them know those opportunities are there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We may be able to get there. So with that, we're going to close that informational hearing. Any questions by the committee about anything you want to know, make sure you get a hold of Lisa. Keep in touch with anything you can do. And
we are meeting next week.
And we are meeting next week. So we'll talk about school finance and some of those things at the end of the week. So with that, we're going to be adjourned. So thank you very much. And thank you guys on the phone.